You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of two podcasts on the clinical use of cannabidiol in neurology care, particularly epilepsy conditions. This two-part series is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage epilepsy, including epileptologists, neurologists, and advanced practice providers and nurses on the care team. In this episode, we'll be talking about some of the clinical data on CBD for epilepsy, then discussing a few concepts surrounding misconceptions and shared decision-making. Again, my name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. And joining me once again is Dr. Scott Perry, who is head of neuroscience at the Jane and John Justin Institute for Mind Health at the Cook Children's Medical Center in Fort Worth, Texas. Dr. Perry has been treating patients with epilepsy for many years and has focused much of his energy on the treatment of childhood epilepsy, specifically surrounding uncontrolled or idiopathic cases. Dr. Perry, thanks for joining us again for our second podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
So in our first podcast, we discussed a little bit how CBD works and some of the conditions that it could be used for, both on-label and off-label. I want to start a little bit more clinically this time. So the current FDA-approved CBD agent is approved for three rare epilepsy conditions. How did these specialized indications come about?
They came from, those were, the target populations of the randomized controlled trials that were done that, ultimately led to the FDA approval. How did they choose those to go after? Several ways. One, the conditions. The conditions were Dravet syndrome, Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and tuberous sclerosis complex. So reasons those were chose. One, there's a need. Those conditions have relatively few. And in fact, Dravet syndrome didn't really have anything approved for the treatment of that condition. There was a clinical need in the population. These are conditions where seizures are not only the primary symptom, but seizures are frequent, and seizures are often treatment resistant. So of all the things we've got to treat the epilepsy in these conditions, we still have people with very uncontrolled seizures. So we need more treatments. Those are some of the primary reasons. There's also, some background preliminary information. Dravet syndrome in particular, people may remember there was a lot of excitement over the use of CBD products in some people before this FDA version came along, CBD products that resulted in some seizure reduction that kind of gave a signal that maybe this is something we should focus on from an epilepsy standpoint.
So talk a little bit about the clinical trials. So you mentioned three disease states, three types of epilepsy. What have the actual data shown with regard to using CBD for these epileptic conditions?
Yeah, sure. We'll go through them kind of together, but a bit separate. I'll just kind of talk to them in phases. These were all phase three clinical trials. They were double blind placebo controlled trials, kind of the gold standard of clinical trial design. Each one, so they included, one study, people with Dravet syndrome, one with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and then another group with tuberous sclerosis. The initial trials were in Dravet syndrome and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and they looked at convulsive seizure types as well as drop seizures. So convulsive seizure types in Dravet syndrome and drop seizures in the Lennox-Gastaut syndrome trial. They focused not only on the efficacy of the medication, but the safety of the medication. And what they found in the initial studies, again, which were Dravet and Lennox-Gastaut, they studied 20 milligram per kilogram dosing versus placebo, and they did secondary studies where they compared 10 milligram per kilogram to 20 milligram per kilogram to placebo. Basic outcomes of these studies is that both of them resulted in significant reduction in seizures compared to placebo. Average kind of median reduction of seizures was about, say about 40%. There was placebo rate generally of around 15 to 20%, so about a 20 to 25% reduction difference compared to the placebo groups in both of those trials. Interestingly, when they compared 10 milligram per kilogram per day dosing to 20 milligram per kilogram per day dosing, there wasn't a significant difference between the overall reduction in those two dose groups. And so that's just something to be aware of. The tuberous sclerosis complex study was designed a little differently in that it looked at doses to 25 to 50 milligrams per kilogram, and again came out with a fairly similar outcome of around 40% reduction compared to placebo. So across the board, we see a reduction, and what we can take from that is that it's not really a dose, probably not a dose-dependent reduction. So what my advice to people is if you just start people on, you know, the lower end of dosing of 10 milligram per kilogram per day, if they're still having seizures but tolerating the medicine well, you got room to go up to 20 to 25 and see if it makes a difference. If it doesn't, then being at the lower dose is probably fine.
So the Dravet syndrome trials and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome trials were first. So it was FDA approved for those two conditions first, right? And tuberous sclerosis later on?
That's correct. Yeah, it was first approved for those two conditions. It was first approved for seizures associated with those conditions from age 2 and up. After the tuberous sclerosis complex trial was done, the age was then 1 year and up, and that's because of who was included in the TS studies.
So how about side effects? You alluded to safety a little bit in there. So what about side effects of this? What came out of the clinical trials?
So overall, I think the take home would be that, you know, the treatment was safe. Side effect profile is similar to side effect profiles we see with other anti-seizure medications. So diarrhea was more common, vomiting reported more commonly, fatigue or somnolence more commonly. Some of those adverse effects were a little more unique. There was a proportion of patients who had elevation of liver enzymes that tended to be people who were also on valproate. And actually, when you look at somnolence was more common in people who were on clobazam, and that's because clobazam and cannabidiol interact such that the metabolite of clobazam gets elevated sometimes as much as 5 or more times. And that results in somnolence. Usually, you'll see that manifest a week or two after, you know, you start that combination of medicines.
So at this point, the perception of CBD is that it's somewhat of an alternative medicine. And I believe you used that term maybe back on our first podcast as well. And it's often tried in patients who have failed initial and subsequent therapies. So do you think that this position in the treatment paradigm might change over time?
I think with all medicines that we have newly approved for, you know, epilepsy, position changes over time. There's a lot that goes into making a decision about what medicine to use. One is, you know, what does it have evidence and showing it's effective for as far as the underlying syndrome type. But then you get mounting evidence over time of, you know, what seizure types might, you know, medicine be good for. Or you get information about what other non-seizure outcomes, you know, does it impact? Because reduction of seizures is not the only outcome we're aiming for in epilepsy. And then, of course, you get, you know, like we talked about, safety and other kind of medicine interactions. So over time, I think as people's experience and comfort with using any treatment grows, you start to find new places for it and new positions in the treatment paradigm.
So in your practice, what would you say are some of the misconceptions surrounding CBD? Is there any misinformation out there on whether it can or even should be taken?
Well, gosh, I'd hope with, you know, these well-designed clinical trials we talked about, we don't have a lot of disagreement about whether or not it's, you know, useful, at least in the epilepsy space. I think that's been answered, that it does have efficacy. I think some misconceptions people have are that what we have as an FDA-approved drug is the same as anything I can get, you know, down the street as a, you know, basically a generic, and I would argue that's not the case. There are very clear differences in kind of manufacturing and oversight of the FDA-approved drug that really differentiate it. I think there's, you know, some you can take some misconception from the data that. The drug and maybe not as effective as some others. You know, like if you look at that, what I said, 40% reduction, you're like, you know, that's not that great. But, you know, you got to remember, first of all, we were studying a population of people who have very drug resistant seizures. So to get a 40% reduction is still a significant thing. And even among people that's a median reduction. So there are people who did a lot better than that as well. So as with all medications, there are people who are at the extremes of doing very, very well and people who, you know, maybe had no response at all. So in these populations in particular, I think it's important to remember those opportunities are out there, and these treatments are valuable because of that.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about multidisciplinary care for epilepsy. So as a practicing neurologist in the pediatric arena, you're a specialist who helps manage these patients throughout the disease course. What other types of clinicians are involved along the way, and what has been their perception of CBD in your experience?
Well, yeah, in my role taking care of developmental and epileptic encephalopathies, and there's almost, I can't think of a specialist that's not involved in the care of people I take care of. Common kind of specialist I interact with would be, you know, orthopedics, physical medicine and rehabilitation, GI, are probably some of the more common, psychology, developmental pediatrics. As far as perception within them on the use of cannabidiol, I honestly have not really seen any adverse perception. I think they recognize the data as I presented here, as well as others do. I've actually seen, kind of alluding to our conversation in the first podcast, I've seen some of the folks in physical medicine using you know, some forms of CBD products for things like spasticity. Even, you know, it's not approved for that, but feeling like there may be some improvement in spasticity. So, you know, they're investigating some other non-seizure uses of the medication. And as I said earlier, you know, there's some evidence, at least from a patient report standpoint, or family report standpoint, that there's some non-seizure improvements in like behavior and sleep and some other comorbid conditions like that. So I think people recognize there's a place for it, and that we're probably going to continue to refine exactly where it's best used over time.
So kind of along these lines, I also wanted to briefly mention shared decision-making. It's obviously an important aspect of medicine in any specialty, but perhaps particularly so when discussing CBD. So how do you approach this conversation with patients, talking about CBD?
I think in decisions in general, I approach clinical and treatment decisions the same, no matter what I'm talking about, which is that, you know, my goals in therapy are not always the goals of the people I'm trying to treat, right? So it's important to understand what are everyone's goals. Mine may be, you know, a certain amount of seizure reduction, and theirs may be more about less adverse effect and quality of life and less seizure reduction. So the first thing is to have that conversation with a patient to understand, you know, what are they trying to achieve with the next therapy. Once you understand what you're trying to achieve, then you can look at, you know, the collection of therapies we have available to us. As it relates to CBD, you know, you're able to talk about well-designed studies that tell us what the efficacy are with certain conditions and certain seizure types. You're able to talk about the safety or adverse effect profile of the medication, so that the patient can consider that and decide if those adverse effects are kind of fit within, you know, what they're willing to potentially experience for what they might get out of the efficacy. And then, you know, give them a chance to ask the questions they have to make the choice that's, you know, that really fits best with their goals. I think a lot of times patients and caregivers maybe don't get as much credit as they deserve for what they understand. And I think if, you know, you present that information to them, give them an opportunity to ask questions, you'll find that they do understand and want to be involved in the decision-making process in that way.
So let's finish up on this. How would you describe the current outlook for the use of CBD in clinical practice? Do you think we're in a good spot with the comfort level of both patients and clinicians to take CBD or to use CBD, or are there specific needs or barriers to overcome in the next few years?
I mean, I would say overall, CBD has been accepted pretty well as a treatment. I think it's a accepted treatment of epilepsy. I think the barrier is that, you know, as it relates to its indications, it kind of limits it to some degree to those three conditions. It's not necessarily a drug that the mechanism suggests that it would only be good for those three conditions. And those three conditions really contain essentially all seizure types that can occur in epilepsy. So I think, you know, that potential barrier is just, you know, hopefully it's overcome with time and experience as we start to see other conditions that respond well to it, other underlying reasons for epilepsy. But I think the appetite for, you know, considering it as a treatment alongside every other anti-seizure medication we have is good.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Perry. I appreciate your insights and wish you the best in continuing to manage these complex patients in your practice. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today. Hopefully you're able to tune into our first podcast in the series as well. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Jazz Pharmaceuticals, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.